Okay. Thanks, Ronnie. Rosera asked me to give some kind of theoretical overview, so that's sort of my plan. Let's say theoretical introduction maybe to twisted bilayer graphene. Maybe a few words what it won't be. It will not be a survey of theoretical papers. With this many people in here, I guess there are probably at least 10 people in this audience who've probably authored papers on twisted bilayer graphene, theory papers. Show of hands, anyone who has? Some of you I know have and not raising your hand, so okay. I'm not going to review your papers, okay? Or anybody else's, basically, all right? I want it because it's impossible. And so that's not the purpose. What I'll try to do is give sort of the minimal amount of information I think that would help you to understand maybe what's going on. Although it's a very young field, it's kind of early to review, but still, it's interesting. I hope you all went to Andrea's talk. I'm not going to start by reviewing the experiments. You got that yesterday. I'll come back and talk about that. So the plan is you need to know something about single layer graphene, so I'll start with that. Okay. Again, I'm going to assume that probably all of you have seen something about single layer graphene because most of you teach it in a class or took it in a class. I'll just tell you sort of the minimal amount of information that I think is sort of relevant to twisted bilayer graphene. And then I'll talk about the moiré structure, just like the physical structure, what it is. And then I'll talk about the moiré band structure, which is interesting. And then I'll try to conclude by talking about interactions. Then we'll come back to experiments and try to ask what's important, how you should think about it, what we know and what we don't know. So feel free to interrupt. All right, so let me start with graphene, okay? So everybody has probably worked out this nice tight binding model of graphene, okay? I'm always going to orient, kind of think about my reference graphene oriented like this, okay? So there's a bond along the y direction. I just like to orient it like that, all right? If that's real space, then in reciprocal space, famously, there are the Brillouin zone is a hexagon like this. This is the Brillouin zone. A bunch of these would be reciprocal lattice points like this. Okay. You have two sites in the unit cell. So the simplest model of the low energy bands near the Fermi energy is a two band model, and those bands touch. They form Dirac points at these two inequivalent zone corners. So this is one of them. This is another one. This is also K prime here. Okay. this point, and this point are equivalent up to reciprocal lattice vectors. Okay. And the others, these are equivalent to each other. So if we were to actually draw the bands, which I'm not going to do in any realistic way, they would, you know, in a very cartoonish fashion, they look something like this. Okay, and of course, they're periodic. If I take some cut, let's say maybe along this direction or something, I go through both Dirac points. Very basic thing that's important to know is the bandwidth here, so kind of the distance. We call this maybe the bandwidth of the conduction band or the valence band. It's huge. It's something like 8 electron volts. Okay. And so that makes this Dirac, this velocity of this electrons here. So if we write the energy, some velocity times the distance from this Dirac point here, and that velocity is fast. It's like 1/300th of the speed of light. So what else do I need to tell you? For most purposes, and basically every purpose in all these twisted bilayer graphene experiments, we're studying kind of low energy physics. So the structures that we'll look at are huge, very long length scales compared to this graphene lattice spacing. The energies of the bands we consider are tiny. They're tens of millivolt energies compared to this. So everything happens in some very narrow window of energy and momentum like this. Okay. So this, we can basically forget about details of the bands away from here. And it's an excellent approximation to just think about this kind of a Dirac fermion here and here. I'll call these valleys, okay? So there's the K valley and the K prime valley, or the first and the second valley. And there's a, you can write a Dirac Hamiltonian for this thing, which looks something like this. So just to orient you, there are going to be a lot of Dirac matrices, or Pauli matrices tend to float around in this, in graphene. One set of these Pauli matrices come from the sublattice structure of graphene. There's two sublattices. Okay, so that's these Pauli matrices, tau x and tau y, they act in this sublattice space. So we can sort of think we're labeling them by the quantum numbers of tau z, which is plus or minus 1, corresponds to the A or the B sublattice. Okay, so this, and here, you know, in an abuse of notation, okay, this is a momentum measured from the Dirac point, not from zero. Okay. So the fact that these are only the tau x and tau y Pauli matrices appear, that's basically because electrons always hop from one sublattice to the other. That's A, this is B. So all the hopping from one site goes from A to B or B to A. That's why tau z is not appearing there. Okay. Okay, and this plus or minus, it depends which valley you're at. Okay, so this is textbook stuff. There's a huge review article. Falco, Paco Ganea, other people. You can look. It's a good reference. So this, you know, this Dirac nature, the fact that these bands touch at a point, is sort of interesting in and of itself. There's a little bit of topology involved. So you need to know a little bit to at least understand some of the experiments, why it might be important. So very basics of topological aspects of band theory. Okay, at least the basic notions come from the idea of Berry phase. Okay, as an electron propagates around in a band, it can accumulate a geometric phase, a Berry phase. The standard thing is to ask about how that phase changes in moving from one momentum to another for a non-degenerate band. You define the Berry gauge field, A, which is a function of K, which is something like, I'm not trying to get signs correct, okay? You have some block state, you take the gradient of the, so we write a block. Block's theorem tells us we can write a wave function as e to the I k dot r times a periodic function, n is some band index. Okay. So for a given band, we can define this Berry gauge field A. Okay. By just taking the gradient of the periodic part of the block function and it overlap with this. And that's purely imaginary, basically, because it's normalized. Okay. That's not gauge invariant in the sense that just when you solve the band theory problem, there's some arbitrary phase you could associate with that wave function. So depending how you change what phase you choose for the wave function HK, you'll get a different answer for A. So what's gauge invariant is just like in electromagnetism, the curl of that is gauge invariant. So that's actually called the Berry curvature. Again, you can associate with a band. These are all momentum space gradients. Okay. In 2D, that's just a scalar. We can think that's just epsilon ij d a j d decay I. Or Z hat, there's only one curl, just the flux sort of going through the plane in momentum space. So it's like an effective magnetic field in momentum space, and the meaning is that if you take an electron around some closed orbit in momentum space, it picks up the Aronoff bone phase associated with that flux inside the loop. Okay. Now it turns out that the Berry curvature, hopefully I get this right, if we have time reversal symmetry, B of K is minus B of minus K. Okay, so under time reversal, momentum changes sign, and it's like a magnetic field, it changes sign. If we have inversion symmetry, K changes sign, but it's but the Berry curvature doesn't change sign. So the difference is that time reversal involves conjugation, and you can see this is an imaginary part, so it changes, has an extra sign change under complex conjugation. So if you have these two things together, then B has to be zero. Everywhere, for all K. Okay. And that's true in ideal graphene. There is an inversion center, you know, for example here. The center of a hexagon is an inversion center. Okay, so the Berry curvature is just zero there. The simplest sort of topological quantity would be the integral of the Berry curvature over the whole Grillon zone. That's basically up to normalization. That's the Chern number. It's related to the Hall effect. But that's just zero for graphene, okay? Because B is zero everywhere. So it doesn't sound like graphene is very topological. However, it has there is a feature, a way that it creeps in here a little bit, which is that from the very starting point, this Berry gauge field is only defined when you have a non-degenerate band, and we have this point of band touching. And so there's some sort of singularity in momentum space at the location of the Dirac point. So if we sort of go to K-space and here's the K-point, it turns out that if we take the line integral of A dot dk in a line that goes around the K-point, okay, that's not zero, okay? And that's actually plus or minus pi. Now, plus or minus, why? Actually, the sign is indeterminate. Okay, I mentioned that A itself depends on a gauge choice. Okay, the flux is gauge invariant, but the flux is zero, we saw. But you can make a large gauge transformation that allows, since the wave functions in the upper band, say, they're not defined when you go right to the K point. It's degenerate, so you can choose different gauges where just multiply the wave function by a phase that winds by plus or minus 2 pi around that point. And that will change this by an integer multiple of 2 pi. So this quantity is only actually defined mod 2 pi. Okay. So, you know, if the Berry curvature were defined everywhere, which it isn't, because the bands are not, they are degenerate at the K-point, then we could use Stokes' theorem to relate this to the integral, the double integral in this region of B, BZ. Okay. And so this would imply that there's a Berry curvature inside there. Okay. So it's not true. Okay, we can't actually do this. But it tells you almost have Berry curvature. Right? So graphene, kind of ideal graphene, has kind of an incipient Berry curvature. And you can make that Berry curvature real by breaking one of these symmetries, breaking either time reversal or inversion. Okay. So even a sort of trivial thing can create the Berry curvature. We can break inversion by just adding a staggered potential and add a You know, and microscopically, we could add a term to the Hamiltonian, which is a sum on A sites of some, let's call it U or V, and I minus sum on B sites of the same potential. So it just raises the and lowers the energy on the two sublattices. That breaks inversion, because inversion interchanges A and B sublattices. It's obviously not creating any sort of topological state, really, in graphene. But what it does do is it adds a mass. It'll appear as a term where M is proportional to this potential V here at these two Dirac points. So just even this very simple thing, and in these graphene experiments, they're done these days. Experiments are always done with a layer of hexagonal boron nitride above and usually below, and that actually does break this symmetry between the two sublattices. So that's an effect that happens without any correlations, just because of the way the samples are made. So this is expected to be a real effect. The magnitude is probably highly dependent on the experiment, but it's there. And as soon as you make a mass, this vanishing of Berry curvature is not true, and the B becomes zero. And it's sorry, B. It's a scalar here, and it's proportional to the sign of the mass, and it's proportional to the which Dirac point you're at due to this plus or minus sign. And you end up, if you were to plot B versus Kx and Ky around the Dirac point for one sign of this potential, you'll get a positive Berry curvature, very peaked around the origin. For the other sign, let's say M greater than 0 and M less than 0, you'll get a Berry curvature peak below. Okay. And the opposite will occur at the other Dirac point, okay, the other valley. Okay. And the integral will be pi. Because it was almost was equal to pi before. And it's in some narrow region of width m. So the integral of b d to k around one Dirac point will be pi, plus or minus pi, and it depends on the sign of the mass. Okay. So the most important thing about Berry curvature is it's related to the Hall conductivity. The Hall conductivity, sigma xy, is basically e squared over h times the integral over all the occupied bands divided by 2 pi. Okay. So in graphene, you have to add the contributions from the two valleys. So actually, you know, this state where we had a sublattice potential doesn't break time reversal symmetry. Obviously, the Hall conductivity should be zero. And you should think of that occurring because one occupied band here gives pi and the other gives minus pi. So this is from, let's say, the K valley. This is from the K prime valley, and they add to zero. Okay. And divide by 2. So if you could figure out a way to cook up the system so that this cancellation doesn't happen, then you can suddenly get a big, even quantized Hall effect. Okay.
How about tension on the membrane? What can that generate?
Can we come to it later?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's part, I don't know, 1 and 2, somewhere in there, okay? I'll mention, but I won't go into it. You know, there's a famous Haldane model, which is a model for graphene without spin, where you actually get this cancellation not to occur. And the way he does it is by breaking time reversal rather than inversion symmetry, by adding some funny perturbation involving imaginary hopping. Okay, that will generate a mass which is the opposite sign for the two valleys. So here. Just a simple perturbation generates a mass that's the same sign for the two valleys. Okay. And this, you know, this we know will happen just by simple physics of the hexagonal boron nitride. Nobody actually knows how to generate the opposite sign mass in a condensed matter system for graphene. Okay, let's see. I think it's probably all that I wanted to say about basics of graphene. This is what you need to know, okay? They're Dirac fermions, they're two sublattices, and they have this incipient topology, okay? It doesn't take much, even a very small mass, if you put the Fermi level in the gap, will generate a Berry curvature. Yeah?
So hexagonal boron nitride and graphene have different lattice constants, so even if you sort of align them on top of one another, with this, the different sublattices went perfectly aligned over one another. So is this simple picture of inversion symmetry breaking still okay to use?
Turns out it's okay. It's okay. A bit of a long story, but that's an old, like graphene and boron nitride have been used for at least probably a decade in graphene research. So this is one of the questions that was an interesting question 7 or 8 years ago. It's known now. Okay. Even if it's not aligned, you generate a mass. The actual value of the mass will depend on details like that.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, I want to move on to the next part, which is the structure. Right? I need to pull this thing down. Now I'm going to show you some pictures. You got to see the pictures, of course. Right. All right, so here's this is actually two sheets of graphene. You can't tell because they're on top of one another. All right, and you twist one relative to the other, and you see these nice patterns appear. Okay, and just to your eye, you can notice several things, okay? There's sort of different regions that look different to you. We twisted around the center here, so the center almost doesn't twist at all by a small angle. So the center is still aligned. It basically looks almost like it did when it was untwisted. I started with a configuration, which is what we call AA graphene, where one layer is directly on top of one another. It's kind of a nice symmetric point to start. So in the middle, it stays AA. And you can see the AA is kind of reappearing in different places here. However, in between, you see something very different. Let's say, here's a good spot right here. We have sort of the opposite choice. This is what you'd call either AB or BA. So that this is this sort of convention. You can we're trying to describe which sites are on top of one another. So in the bottom layer, we have A and B sites. In AA, the A site on the bottom is aligned with an A site on the top, and actually so is BB, so we might call it AABB. In this region, only one site on the bottom is aligned with one on the top, so perhaps we'd call it an AB if A is on the bottom and B is on the top. If you look around, you'll find another region, which is BA, somewhere, which, okay, I invite you to try to find it, okay, which looks the same with the colors reversed, all right? Maybe it's here, this looks like one maybe. Okay. Another thing your eye picks out is that the pattern looks periodic. This is actually a 6-degree rotation. Okay. The pattern is obviously, the periodicity is much bigger than the microscopic lattice. You can try to draw. I just drew it. Structure, it looks like a triangular lattice. Okay. If you think about it, again, the way I started drawing it, there was one Bravais lattice vector, is my hexagon here. I drew it with a graphene bond in the y direction. So one of the primitive translations of the graphene structure is in the x direction. This is one of the lattice vectors, right? In this structure, the superstructure, you can see there's one lattice vector almost in the y direction. Okay, so sort of this emergent lattice that shows up is actually 90 degree rotated from the original one. You can see it. If you make the rotation smaller, this is a 2-degree angle, it gets bigger. I just rescaled the lattice so it still fits, all right? But you can see how much smaller the lattice spacing is compared to the structure. Okay, but you can still see the same thing. Here's AA regions again. To emphasize, okay, this is actually where the experiments are being done in for the most part. In Andrea's lab, for example, is a 1 degree rotation, and there's some issue with the graphics. I'm running into rasterization because I made the hexagons too small. But it's a huge length scale compared to the microscopic scale. So that should tell us as theorists, you know, it's kind of a waste to try to model this whole thing at the microscopic level of the lattice. We should try to be thinking in some way where we can subsume that. Let's see. So it's nice to think in momentum space. This part is sort of important. Okay. So a starting way to think about this is I drew the Brillouin zone in momentum space, and the Dirac fermions lived at the corners. When we have two layers, we have two of these Brillouin zones, and if we rotate in real space by theta, we also rotate in momentum space by theta. Okay. So here are two rotated copies. Just for symmetry, I sort of rotate one up and one down. Okay. And so if we just rotate them, but imagine leaving the layers far apart so they don't actually talk to one another, there'll be a Dirac point at one layer at this point from one layer and a Dirac point at this point from another layer. Okay. You can do a little geometry. I'll explain in a second the geometry. But it turns out that these two points can be regarded as the corners of the Brillouin zone of this large superstructure. What we want to discuss is the bands of this superstructure. A big band structure in real space, a big superlattice in real space means small bands in momentum space. So we're interested in this kind of small region of K-space. Remember, small K-space is where the Dirac model is good. So that's kind of why the Dirac model is good. Again, this is realistic. Okay, that's actually the size of the Brillouin zone in the experiment. Okay, again, it's kind of foolish to model the whole band when all we care about is that.
Sorry, last question.
Yeah.
So if you rotate it at a random angle, you will get presumably into quasicrystal, which doesn't have periodicity.
Yeah.
So is this?
Give me a second. Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Oh, it keeps going on its own. That's nice. That was mostly about the Moiré structure. I am going to come back eventually to say something relevant to your question, Mark, but you still have to wait. Okay. But almost ready for Victor's question. So let's first off, I just want to see. I pointed out some structure from those pictures that you saw, that the Bravais lattice of the Moiré pattern is 90 degree rotated from the microscopic one. Can we understand that? That's just geometry, okay? But this is kind of a useful bit of geometry to understand. You all know that if we do a rotation in real space. Rotation is described by, in two dimensions, is basically a two-dimensional system. A rotation is described by an orthogonal matrix whose elements are something like cosine theta, sine theta, minus sine theta, cosine theta. Okay, so for a small rotation, this is just 1 theta minus theta 1. Okay, if we think about rotating points in a lattice, in a plane, what we're doing is we're mapping some point to another point, which is approximately shifted by, let me use R. Z hat cross R. So the generator of rotations is this Z hat cross, okay? So this is for a general distortion of some two-dimensional body. This would be what we would call the displacement field. Okay, And so we can imagine we rotate around some center. In the center of our lattice, the structure is aligned. Okay, we consider a small angle. So in the center, it remains aligned because the rotation is very small. As we move far from the center, the displacement of the atoms, the sites, gets bigger. Okay, because it's proportional to R. Eventually, it's obvious the structure is displaced. However, we can ask when the structure will look periodic if this displacement is equal to a lattice vector. So we just ask, when is U equal to A, which is some microscopic Bravais lattice vector, okay? So that's simple. Theta z hat cross R is A, and it gives solutions where A is 1 over theta minus 1 over theta z hat cross A. Okay. So if I actually move in this large lattice by a vector big A, which is just enlarged from the little a by a factor of 1 over theta, okay, theta is 1 degree, so the theta is, of course, in radians, right, so it's actually tiny, right, you get a bigger vector, and the vector is perpendicular to A. So the z hat here is that's just the condition. These are the moiré for any given microscopic A of graphene. This is the moiré Bravais lattice vector. Okay, and you can see they're perpendicular to the original ones. That's why it's rotated. It's very simple. Okay. So Victor's question. Okay. For this to be a really strictly periodic structure, this has to be actually a lattice vector, a graphene. Otherwise, I can't actually move in the lattice by this vector. And for a generic theta, it isn't. Okay. So generically, actually, the structure is quasi-periodic. When theta is small, though, there's always a graphene lattice vector, which is very, very close to this. And that's why, effectively, the quasi-periodicity is not very important for small theta. So that's a partial answer to your question. Let's have a little bit better answer to your question. So you can think about there's a sort of, this twisting generates some sort of effective potential. We'll try to model it a little bit better. But on this scale of this moiré lattice, and let me go back to this twisted picture. So here's our underlying untwisted Brillouin zone, and we by twisting we move the k of one layer up here and the k of the other layer down here. And that's okay. I invite you to do the geometry to check that this is correct. Okay, but it's kind of clear because this distance is the size of k. Okay, and the amount it rotates is theta. So here, to move the point symmetrically up and down, I rotate one layer by theta over 2, the other by minus theta over 2. Okay, so this length is approximately k times theta. So the momentum, and it's perpendicular to the original k. And it's the real space zone increased by 1 over theta, so the Brillouin zone should decrease by theta, and it should be perpendicular. So those are all those conditions. And again, you know, the real picture is much smaller. These are actually the, something like this, or let's say this one. This is actually what I'd call a little b, which is a Bravais lattice vector, a reciprocal lattice vector of the moiré structure. Okay, I'll call it actually q, maybe. Okay. And so if you think about electrons, they can kind of Bragg scatter. Off the moiré. But they can pick up just this amount of momentum, so they can scatter like this much in one Bragg scattering. Of course, they can multiply scatter. So electron can scatter again and again and again and again and eventually reach K prime. Okay. If it eventually can scatter all the way from here to here, then it can sense the distance between K and K prime, and that's the only relic of the lattice spacing in the low-energy band structure. So that's the only way the system can know that it's quasi-periodic, is by scattering from one Dirac valley to the other. But it requires a number of scattering events that are basically of order 1 over theta. Okay. Bless you. And again, I've exaggerated this, so the number of scattering events that would be needed for 1-degree graphene is, I don't know, 40 or something. It's a large number. Okay. And basically, the higher multiple scattering events are extremely, extremely suppressed. Okay. So it's an excellent approximation to say that the electrons at this valley, they never talk to the electrons over here. And in that approximation, quasi-periodic becomes as good as periodic. Come on. Good. Anything else here? All right. Good. So this is a reason for basically there's no valley mixing. When the angle is small. Okay. Another good thing about this picture, it's nice to think in... when I've drawn this picture, I explain that this is... If we didn't let our layers... coupled, this would be the Dirac point in layer 1, and this would be the Dirac point in layer 2. Okay. But the whole point of these twisted structures is that layers do talk to one another. Electrons start tunneling between the two layers. However, if you think about the energy dispersion, so it's maybe nice to imagine a cut like this. So this is going to be, I'm going to take a cut vertically through this picture. Cutting right through the original location of the Dirac point. Okay, this is the k-axis and this is energy. If I have no tunneling between these layers, I'll have a Dirac point at layer 1, let's say, here, and another Dirac point at layer 2 here. So this is coming from layer 1 and from layer 2. These curves just cross each other because I don't have any tunneling. The important point is that if you look at the states at the same momentum in the second layer, they're very non-resonant with the original one. Okay, they're off at some other energy. So if I introduce tunneling between layer 1 and layer 2, it's not going to do very much to the states down here. Okay, and if it's weak. And likewise here. So this is. And that immediately tells you, bless you, that if the tunneling is weak, those Dirac points are stable. Okay. So we can expect that the two Dirac points coming from the two layers is just going to be stable. Where is there a resonant tunneling? Well, here. Okay. Here, this is a band from layer, let's say layer 1 here, coming out here, and this is a band from layer 2. Now I introduce tunneling between the two layers, those states will repel. So when I introduce tunneling, what will happen is there'll be an anti-crossing here and another one also here. Okay. And to put some labels on this, so this distance here, oh, this is a terrible color, how about this one? Yeah. This distance here is basically k times theta. Okay. So this is often called k sub theta, small k because it's small. Okay. That's the splitting of the two Dirac points in momentum space. So this height is v k theta over 2. Okay. This anti-crossing will get pushed down by an amount that's kind of proportional to T prime. Okay. It's not really equal to T prime, but sort of proportional to T prime. Where T prime is going to be some interlayer tunneling. Okay. And so you can see that the effect of T prime, it's not going to remove these Dirac points, but it is going to flatten the bands somewhat. and that will reduce the velocity. And that was well known, actually, for many years. And you can kind of guess that something interesting happens when T prime becomes comparable to Vk theta. Okay. Probably the only really strong, completely solid theoretical result in this field is that we know what happens now, at least for the simplest model of graphene, and it's interesting.
Okay. And T prime here is the interlayers?
Yes, yeah. Right, because it's this, the size of the anti-crossing between the states in layer 1 and layer 2.
So, but the basic Hamiltonian, is it formulated in real space? T prime is just one number? Or it's inhomogeneous?
Let me get it to it, and we're going to get there, okay? Yeah, but it's slightly inhomogeneous, but so that's why T prime here is some sort of average of the local T primes, actually. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's a bit smaller than the maximum T prime, but yeah.
Do you mean you think deep was resonant, just that they don't
really scan? It just means they're not degenerate, so. You know, in perturbation, thinking about small t primes of perturbation theory, perturbation theory gives a large level shift if you start with two levels that are degenerate. If they're very non-degenerate, the level shift is small. That's all.
Can you please explain that? How can you make t prime comparable to k theta?
Okay, so t prime is
is
an intrinsic property, but k theta is completely dependent on theta. Okay.
So you are going to tune theta.
Exactly. What you should think of is T prime is given to us by graphene, more or less, and you change theta. Okay. Yeah. Good.
Exactly.
Okay. Good. So, you know, why would we want to do this in the first place? Okay. One very simple thing to notice already from this picture, okay, the basic bandwidth, naive bandwidth that we'd have for this Moiré structure is V times K theta. Okay. And that's just a trivial effect, basically. This is sort of trivial band scaling. Anytime you make a big superlattice in real space, it's going to be a small structure in momentum space, and you'll decrease the dispersion because you can't move as far in momentum space. So this is true, for example, for electrons in semiconductors. You make semiconductor heterostructures, they do this. Okay. And this is just a purely geometrical effect. It's just proportional to theta. Okay. However, you can see some additional effect. If T prime, this T prime becomes comparable to Vk theta, it may be sort of especially flat. Okay. And that's actually important. Yeah, why is it important? Okay, maybe that's worth a comment. Okay, it's real space structure. Okay, I'm not going to try to draw it, but we have this big Moiré structure. You can think it's got kind of a large unit cell whose size is determined by these A vectors, which are kind of order the lattice spacing divided by theta. Okay. We expect to see correlations in a system when the at least strong correlations when the kind of local Hubbard interaction is comparable to the bandwidth. Okay, it's the usual correlation criterion. Okay, I need to speed up. It's by decreasing theta, making these small twists, we make the lattice scale bigger and trivially make the bandwidth smaller. Okay, so this is proportional to theta. Our unit cell is getting bigger, so if we confine an electron to that unit cell, the Coulomb energy of that confinement is also smaller. Okay. So the naive estimate for U is something like the charging energy in one unit divided by some dielectric constant times the lattice spacing A. Okay, that's the charge energy to put one electron in that thing. And that, since A is like 1 over theta, that's actually proportional to theta. Okay. So while twisting makes a unit cell bigger and decreases W, it actually also decreases U in the same way. So it's not enough. So to actually make correlations, we have to either somehow find a way to make U bigger or make W even smaller than just that naive scaling. That's why it's actually important, some extra effect beyond just the geometrical one. Okay. And that's what people call this magic angle. That happens, this magic angle effect happens when theta is close to 1 degree. Okay. So, yeah, how do we know? Okay, the way we know is that, so you can't really trust this perturbation theory argument. Okay, this is an argument for small t prime. If I tell you that, well, this band gets really flat when t prime is equal to vk theta, you shouldn't really believe it because that's already when t prime is now order 1. It's not within the range of perturbation theory. Okay, so we need a model that can work for any ratio of t prime and vk theta. Okay, and that was actually figured out by Bistritzer and McDonald. That's the only paper I will cite, I guess, which is in PNAS in 2011. Okay, what they did was to basically find a model that describes the physics within this tiny Brillouin zone. Okay, they derived a continuum model. CM. And once they derive it, you can solve it, okay? And they solve it, right? And that turns out to predict these magic angles. So it's probably this continuum model, and there are variations of it now. You know, of course, there are 100 papers on this, so at least a half dozen different versions of continuum model with small modifications. But I'd like to explain how you can understand it in a sort of simple way. Okay. I guess that's the second paper I'll cite, but I don't remember the citation. So, if you look on the archive, you'll see some paper I posted recently, like a month ago or something, even less, about this. So, it's all details of this very simple derivation. It's like a teaching paper, not a research paper. Somehow, okay. Simple. But let me explain roughly where it comes from. Okay. What is it that they did? So, what they did was to derive basically a continuum Hamiltonian, so I'll write the Hamiltonian density, all right, that describes this Moiré structure, and it's valid under two conditions, basically when the angle is small and T prime is small compared to the bandwidth or compared to the T of the graphene. Okay, these are both very good conditions. I mentioned that the bandwidth of graphene is like 8 electron volts, as T prime is a few hundred millivolts. Theta is 1 degree, which is very tiny in radians, right? So let me explain how you can think about this. You saw from the pictures that when you have this very small angle rotation, locally the lattice looks in one region like an AA region, another region like an AB region, another like a BA region. In fact, everywhere it just looks like two layers that are just displaced by some amount. Okay. The idea is that the Hamiltonian density at some position x will actually just depend on the relative displacements, more generally, the displacements of the two layers. Okay. And the most important dependence is just on the difference of the displacements in the two layers. Okay, there'll be some region where that displacement is basically zero, or a multiple of the lattice spacing, so it looks like AA. In other regions where it's turns out if it's one graphene carbon-carbon distance, that's not a lattice spacing, that'll turn AA to AB. You do it twice, it turns it to BA, and three times back to AA. That's a little geometry of graphene.
Sorry, no, it's impossible to see from here. What are the variables? One is U.
I'm sorry. So what I'm writing is now we have two graphene layers, and each one we can imagine displacing. Okay, so I'm going to write a displacement field so that maybe clear about this. So if you think of a point in ideal graphene that might be, let's say, the center of a hexagon of graphene, it would be located at some Bravais lattice vectors R, some periodic vectors R, in the twisted or deformed structure, it'll be shifted by some displacement field U, okay? And conventionally, we would label the displacement field by the original location. Okay, now we have to do this actually separately for each layer. So this U will have a layer index L, which could be 1 or 2. So there's one small. This is sort of a general principle of low energy effective field theory, if you want, that when we have a slowly varying system and a small perturbation to some underlying Hamiltonian, there's an effective description which is local, and as a local function of how the system varies, and can be expressed perturbatively in the perturbations. So in this case, we want to think that our unperturbed system is two ideal graphene layers right on top of one another. And there's two perturbations. One perturbation is a small distortion, this displacement, some sort of deformation of each layer. And the other perturbation is weak interlayer tunneling. Okay, that's, again, these two smallness conditions appearing here. Okay. Maybe I should write this somewhere else down here. So our unperturbed Hamiltonian. We'll have a Dirac fermion in one layer, all right. In real space, something like this. There'll be a same thing for the second layer. Oops. Where there's no vector on the V. Okay, so this is sort of unperturbed Hamiltonian. That's two Dirac Hamiltonians. I'm only writing the Hamiltonian for one K point, okay? Because we said they didn't mix, so it's like a plus K point. And now we need to add the effects of these perturbations, okay? So there are two kinds of effects. So there's one sort of trivial effect that you already saw in this drawing, which is even before the layers talk to one another, just the fact that we twist them moves the K points. So there's no energetics changing in that picture. We can imagine we just rotate the two layers, but don't change any physics. So in the local coordinate system, each layer has its own Dirac fermions doing its own happy thing. But our goal is to use this sort of general principles of effective field theory to write a Hamiltonian density which is local in real space. And we can't use different coordinate systems for the two layers. We have to use the same coordinate system. Okay. So one important effect is just transforming to global coordinates. Right. That doesn't change any physics in principle, but we need to do it to incorporate any perturbations. Okay.
So R would have an index R1 and R2 for the top line and the bottom line in principle. And here you're trying to say, oh, we really need one R.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I want to express this. So exactly. I want to express this in local coordinates, in the global coordinates in the lab frame. Really some same position. Okay. For example, if we try to use local coordinates in the two layers, we'll run into trouble with tunneling because an electron is just going to tunnel locally in real space. Okay. It's going to tunnel from the same physical position, just a little bit vertically. Okay. That's why you need to do this. The second set of effects, which are well known, which are things like you asked about, Mark, which are effects of strains. Okay, so this has been studied heavily in graphene, you know, for the last 15, 20 years. It's pretty well understood. For ideal twisted bilayer graphene, there is no strain. Okay, so it's not really all that important here, but we can incorporate it. Okay. And the most important effect probably is the tunneling. Okay. We can actually basically do this step explicitly. It's just a change of coordinates. Okay, this we can pull out of the literature because it's been done many times before. And this we can deduce the form of the tunneling just by symmetry. Okay. I'll just write the result and justify it. In general, what happens is we have these Dirac-like terms for the two layers. So all these terms I've written, this is just a sum on layers 1 and 2. So you can see there's no mixing of the two layers. So this is all physics within the plane. Okay. So there are various things that appear here. This term that doesn't have any derivatives on the side, this actually corresponds to the rotation of the k-point up or down. Okay. This depends on the u's. This is what's called the strain gauge field. This physics that Mark was asking about, that all appears in here. It's a known function. This is just due to the change of coordinates in general. The polymatrices have to rotate also. Okay. And then on top of that, we have some tunneling term, which turns out to look like this. TJ. This requires a little explanation. So this is taking an electron from layer 1 to layer 2. Okay. And in general, it has some matrix in here because it's a sublattice. We can hop from A to A or A to B or B to A. So this is some 2x2 matrix. This is derived really entirely by symmetry. Okay. And the argument is something like, so this is a constant matrix, three constant matrices. J is 0, 1, and 2. What are the principles? Well, there's one basic principle. If we slide all the layers together, nothing happens. That tells you that the tunneling can only depend on U1 minus U2. Also, if we slide one layer by one lattice spacing, then we just move one microscopic lattice spacing. Then we just move a graphene atom to the next graphene atom. Again, nothing can change in the energy. So it has to be a function of U1 minus U2, and it has to be a periodic with the periodicity of the lattice. So these Qs are the graphene. These have to be graphene reciprocal lattice vectors. Okay. And then there are some additional constraints due to rotational symmetry, because if you rotate, U rotates. Okay, that's a little bit of analysis, but to trust me that this basically works. Okay. And in fact, the important Qs that appear are very simple. So here's our graphene Brillouin zone, okay, and there's K, the Dirac point vector. The Qs that appear is Q0 is actually just 0. Q1 is this one, and Q2, I might have it opposite, I think it's this. Q2 is this one. So these three, my drawing's bad, but they form an equilateral triangle with K in the center. Okay. Those are the three that appear. And then this matrix TJ has a form like this, U plus W zeta to the J tau plus zeta bar to the J tau minus. Maybe it's opposite. I don't remember. I don't know. Okay. Could be some sign mistake. And zeta is e to the 2 pi I over 3. Okay. There's some funny thing. This 2 pi I over 3, third root of unity, appears because we're using threefold rotational symmetry of the lattice.
Is,
yeah.
Is there any 2 pi I j over 3?
No, it's I. This is the, this is, you know, the square root of minus 1.
This is an answer to bar j, right?
Yes.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. Yeah. And J is 0, 1, or 2. Okay. And we're not electrical engineers, so J is 0. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, you can sort of rationalize this. I mean, that the... so this gives some dependence. Depending where you are in the lattice, U1 minus U2 will be something. Okay? For example, if we said U1 minus U2 equals 0, then we're in an AA region, and this should reduce to AA hopping. AA hopping is just diagonal. So you can check that if we put this equal to 0, we have to sum over j. The sum over j of tj, these terms all drop out. And t is proportional to u. It's just the identity matrix. So this is the identity matrix. Okay. So that's AA hopping. If you go instead, you choose u1 minus u2 such that we're in the AB region, you'll find it's proportional to just tau plus. Okay. So this sort of just interpolates between the different local tunneling. So it's very intuitive. You wouldn't even really need the symmetry argument. You could just try to guess a form that interpolates between the different tunnelings you have in the different regions. Okay. So I claim this is a general continuum Hamiltonian, not just for twisted bilayer graphene, but for any low smoothly deformed graphene. Okay. And these U and Ws, they're just determined by symmetry, but by this argument, just looking at different regions, we can see that basically U and W are proportional to T prime. And a little more correctly, you know, U is T prime in an AA region, and W is T prime in an AB region. And there's some factor of 3, okay. Maybe 1/3 or something. Okay. So these are kind of known. So then these parameters are known. There's nothing unknown in here. Everything is known. So I think this is sort of more intuitive than the Bistritzer-McDonald model, even though it's more general. We can just understand that it's just describing locally different tunnelings. And now we can get the Bistritzer-McDonald continuum model by just saying that, well, U1 or U2 is just plus or minus theta over 2 z hat cross r. Okay. So if we do that, then there's no strain. This drops out. Everything else here kind of simplifies. You get a very simple result, which is what they wrote down. Sorry, I'm doing very badly with time. Let me not write it down. Okay, most important thing. So a little magic that happens. We take Q dot U1 minus U2, that's theta Q dot z hat cross r, and we can use cyclicity to write this as theta, let's see, Q and z r Q cross z hat dotted into r. Okay. And so these, if Q is a Bravais lattice, reciprocal lattice vector, this is actually a reciprocal lattice vector of the Moiré pattern. Okay. So just magically it turns into a periodic potential, basically, with the period of the Moiré lattice. Okay. And if you want details of the model, you know, what all this stuff turns into, look at their paper. Okay. All right. I don't know how long you guys want to give me, because I feel like I should...
So usually what we've done in the past is that we have until this room until 12:30, and as long as there's, you know, the discussion ongoing, so, you know, maybe Leon, if you could...
I'm not sure if it's a discussion, but I'm talking.
Right. Yeah, so if you could leave us some time for questions, so
yeah.
We don't push it all the way to 12:30.
Okay, I will definitely try, okay. So just to tell you... you know, just show you some of the results. So once you wrote this continuum model, it's pretty straightforward to calculate with it. That's what they did. They just calculated. And these are done for different angles. This is 5 degree, 1 degree, 0.5 degrees. And you can see something really special happens at 1 degree. You get this extremely flat band. And it's not just monotonic. If you decrease to half a degree, it's not as flat. What they actually did was they defined magic angles by the point at which, when this flatness happens, it's for some very specific angle, the Dirac velocity actually vanishes. Okay, they define magic angles like that. So here what they're plotting, this is kind of an important thing, this alpha parameter. So you saw from that cartoon that there was really one dimensionless parameter that controlled everything. That dimensionless parameter is t prime over vk theta. Okay. So once you've written this continuum model, this is the only parameter that appears. Okay. So it means that, you know, if you could change t prime, as we mentioned, Tanusri, it's hard to change t prime. Okay, it would be entirely equivalent to changing theta. Okay. So that's as a theorist, we prefer to plot versus alpha. Okay. And they show that it happens not. This is about 1 degree. This is, I don't know, 0.55 degrees or something like that. Various things at smaller and smaller angles. Okay. Actually, this thing is tested. So this is sort of the simplest outcome of this analysis, is that only this dimensionless parameter matters. And although it's difficult to change T prime, actually you can do it by applying pressure. So there's a very nice experimental paper by Corey Dean and Andrea. Maybe he showed that data, I don't know, where they took a sample at a slightly larger angle, pressurized it, and showed that it becomes magic. And that's basically experimental proof that that works. Okay. Let's see. Any more here? So then there are lots of other details. They're probably important. Okay. The original Bistritzer-McDonald model basically didn't take into account the fact that the lattice will distort a little bit once you let the layers couple to one another. So in particular, probably the most important effect is the fact that so the two layers like to be in AB stacking, and they don't like to be in AA stacking. So they actually move a little closer together for AB stacking than AA. And that makes a difference between these U and W parameters. And that's important for actually in the band structure. So here's about 1 degree. It's kind of hard to see, but the red curves are the Bistritzer-McDonald results. And you can see the sort of flat bands actually touch the next higher band there. When you put in this difference, actually, they open a gap here. So it makes the low energy bands flatter and more isolated. So that's kind of an important effect. Okay. And there are other lattice relaxation effects. Okay, let me see what I want to say. I'm going to pull this up. Go back. Not this one. Interactions, okay. Now the hard part. Okay. Interaction effects. One more comment about interaction. All right, so all the stuff that you saw from Andrea's talk, and all the interesting stuff is actually due to interactions, okay? And the magic, this magic helps us. We get these bands are very narrow. That's enough to suppress U over W, or make U over W very big. And then all sorts of interesting stuff happens, the superconductivity, different insulating states. Okay. And those effects obviously need interactions of some type. Insulating states that form are related to electron-electron interactions. The superconductors could be electron-electron or electron-phonon. I think there's no clear answer to that question now. Okay. So probably the theorists prefer electron-electron interactions, but not all. I don't know. So just a comment about electron-electron interactions. I showed you sort of how to get this continuum model for the bands based on the idea of effective field theory. Okay, the fact that there should be a local Hamiltonian describing the system locally when it's deformed. You can apply the same logic to electron-electron interactions. And the conclusion of that is basically there are two types of interactions that you can have in a twisted or deformed structure. One of them is just the long-range Coulomb interaction. So if we add, our Hamiltonian will be the band part, plus some interaction part. And the interaction part, in general, has some long-range Coulomb part, which involves... That part is not local, because Coulomb interactions are not local. Okay. In general, it's something like this. There can be some screening if we have some gates nearby. And it will involve the total electron density at position x and the total electron density at position x prime. Okay. And this is kind of guaranteed by the long-range nature of the Coulomb interaction. And then on top of that, there will be local effects, various Gs that involve these Dirac fermions with some matrix in here. And many, many of these couplings, okay? So this is the sort of thing people thought about heavily in just thinking about semiconductors, okay? So remember, all the action we have is near these local Dirac points in K-space. It's very near the kind of band minima. If you think about like a very simple system, like a 2D electron gas and gallium arsenide, you know, people like Bob Laughlin were able to model it to solve the fractional quantum Hall effect by assuming the electrons just have 1 over r Coulomb interaction between one another. Of course, the real electrons are actually block states. They're some complicated thing that have different weights on the different, you know, p orbitals of gallium and arsenide. And their interaction in general is more complicated. Nevertheless, it's true for low energy properties that it's actually a very good approximation to just keep the long range Coulomb. Okay. From these sort of effective field theory arguments, we know that there are corrections to the long range Coulomb, which are things like this. They're called central cell corrections in semiconductor literature. Okay. They're subdominant. They're small by some factor of 1 over the length scale that we studied, basically 1 over the Moiré lattice length scale. Okay. The statement I want to make is, to a first approximation, these are negligible. Okay. It's the same approximation everybody makes in doing effective modeling of electrons in any semiconductor. Okay. All of the device modeling that people do for transistors and stuff is based on this. So we know it works in the real world. Also should work for graphene. Okay. Okay, sometimes these corrections are important. They're small, but they might be important to split some degeneracies or something. Why do I belabor this? Okay, I belabor it because the long-range Coulomb interaction is really the interaction between charge density. Okay, so this thing here is really the density at valley 1 plus the density at valley 2. Okay, the total density of all both spin polarizations of electrons. Okay. If we were to write it out, it would be a sum over valleys and sum over spins, something like this. Okay. So in particular, this has a lot of symmetry. It's symmetric under interchanging the valleys. It's symmetric under rotating the spins. Actually conserves a number of electrons at each valley. Those interactions, this is the only really important statement, is the interactions are approximately symmetric under the full conservation of the number of electrons at each valley. So there's a kind of U1 symmetry of the total charge conservation, is a U1 symmetry of valley conservation, and separate SU2 spin rotations for each valley. I could just as soon have used K and K prime here. Okay. Those are symmetries of the whole Hamiltonian. Yeah.
Given that only the total charge matters, why do you say that you preserve the charge separately in each valley? Wouldn't be enough to just write down U1 of the total charge?
No, so that's a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. Has this extra, the Hamiltonian has an extra symmetry that there are no terms that actually take electrons from one valley and move them to the other. Okay, that's the point of this argument. Okay, that's not going to be an exact symmetry. That's not a microscopic symmetry, but it's an excellent approximation. And that's, you know, these kind of symmetries are important because they could be spontaneously broken, and they can lead to interesting effects. Okay. Also, this separate spin rotation symmetry of the two valleys, maybe that's important too. Okay. All right.
Is there also effectively a layer symmetry if the screen length is much larger than the layer spacing?
No. The layers are not conserved. There's tunneling between the two layers. That was the whole... you can't separately talk about symmetries of the interactions and the layers. Okay. Interactions and the kinetic energy. What really matters are symmetries of the whole Hamiltonian. Good. Okay, so, those are all the sharp statements. And now we start talking about opinions. Let me make a couple, turn to the question of, you know, what should we, now we're theorists, what should theorists think about? Of course we could try to explain the experiments, you know, that's what we should do, all right? And what are the experimental findings, okay? We want to explain, we might want to explain superconductivity. We would like to explain probably these correlated insulators. I don't know if Andrea showed you, there's also a lot of interesting kind of, quote, high temperature transport, maybe strange metal resistivity. These are probably sort of the big questions. There are a lot of sub-questions. What's the mechanism of superconductivity? What symmetry is it? What are the correlated insulator states? There are many, many candidates. How do we tell? Can we predict them? What do they depend on? This type of thing, okay? I think the theorist kind of has to start a little more primitively, probably. Have to start with some sort of point of view. I think there's sort of two kind of obvious points of view. Maybe neither one is quite correct, but and this is what always shows up in thinking about correlated electron systems. There's sort of two views, which are kind of I would call Mott Hubbard versus Slater, Hartree Fock. So basically, you know, when we're confronted with any problem in physics, we tend to think of examples that we already know. So here we have a system with some very flat bands. What are other systems with very flat bands? Very narrow bands. So one sort of system with, where you don't really talk about a flat band, but you talk about a very narrow band, is of course the Hubbard model with some large U. So this, we're thinking about the physics of, you know, transition metal oxides, etc. That's probably the most familiar venue to the people in this room. Okay, cuprates, every other stuff. There's a lot of materials people who know a lot more examples here than I do. We know that when U over T gets bigger than some critical value, you get Mott insulators. You probably get, I think everyone more or less thinks you get interaction-induced superconductivity. Maybe you get strange metal physics, all sorts of complicated things. On complicated lattices, you might get frustration. Basically, all hell breaks loose, right? But maybe it's the kind of hell we like here. I don't know. But at least we have some kind of nice, simple lattice models, can try to study them, although generally it's hard. Okay. The other example of flat bands that have been studied heavily is is the quantum Hall effect, particular fractional quantum Hall effect, where you have flat bands that are partially occupied. Okay, I don't want to miss. Okay, fraction. Hall effect. There's an extremely simple example of this. Obviously, a lot of fractional quantum Hall effect goes beyond Hartree-Fock, and the hope would be maybe there's some interesting fractional quantum Hall-like physics in these systems. But the simplest thing that happens in quantum Hall systems when you have partially filled bands is what's called quantum Hall ferromagnetism. If there's some people in this room that are too young probably to know about it, okay, but it was a big subject in around 2000, late 90s. There's a really beautiful review article by Steve Gervin, which is titled something like Quantum Hall Effect, Novel Excitations and Broken Symmetries. It was published in some book, but you can find it on the archive. I'd highly recommend that article if you want to learn about quantum Hall ferromagnets. The starting point there is like the simplest example is where you have you have Landau levels, and you have a situation where you have a half-filled Landau level with spin. Maybe nobody can see this. Let me put it up here. It's the bottom Landau level. Okay. So in the simplest situation, we imagine we have half filling of this Landau level with spin. So it means we have a total number of electrons, the total number of up spin electrons and down spin electrons is enough to fill one Landau level. And we assume zero Zeeman coupling. For real electrons and gallium arsenide, of course, there is Zeeman coupling, but it's actually very tiny. It's not super important. So without interactions, it's actually a very degenerate thing. You could put put half and half up and down electrons. That's sort of the obvious thing. But since there's a lot of degeneracy in the Landau level, you have a huge number of different states you can put them in. Another thing you could do, though, is take all up electrons or all down electrons. Then the orbital state becomes unique. And it turns out that, in the interest of time, I should sort of wrap this up. But what's important is that to the extent that SU2 spin is a good symmetry, then we can classify the states by their multiplets of SU2. And in particular, by the total spin. And if you put all the electrons in one Landau level, there's, of course, a maximum total spin, which is just n over 2. Okay, that's the biggest you could possibly make. And if we take the state with S total equals n over 2, okay, which is the maximum value, then that's the total spin quantum number, then we can take Sz also equal to this to fix the state completely. This state is actually unique. There's only one state like that. We have to fill every single particle level state of the Landau level. So this is some very simple state. It's like a product over every orbital state in the Landau level of CK up dagger on the vacuum. Once you say you're going to project into a single Landau level, and you say you get the maximum number of spin, there's no choice in this wave function. And of course, general principles of quantum mechanics tell us I can always diagonalize spin and the Hamiltonian if it's a good symmetry. And so this will be an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And it turns out for Coulomb interactions, this is the ground state. This is flat band ferromagnetism. This is the only real example where it actually happens. In graphene, similar things have been explored in high magnetic fields. Graphene adds an extra twist where, in addition to spin, you have valley. So you can think about states that are polarized in valley as well as spin. There's kind of a simple picture for this. So we can think about states, for example, which every spin is up and every valley is one. That's a kind of a unique state. If we have an isolated band to put electrons in. In this, I never really drew the band structure for you, but it looks like that, right? They all look like that. If this inversion symmetry is broken, then actually these flat conduction and valence bands will be separated a little bit. There'll be a gap between them. And you can imagine states like this where I start filling only, let's say, one of these bands. Fill everything below the Fermi energy, and I fill only one of these bands, maybe for up spin and valley one. And I can start filling discrete numbers of those bands. Okay. So those sort of ferromagnetic states, there are various quantum Hall ferromagnets that can occur. And these are basically Hartree-Fock states. Okay. In some limit, they're exact ground states, but they may not be. These are sort of the simplest correlated states you could get, and they will only occur with an integer number of filled bands. So these states always occur with what we would call kind of n equals 1, 2, 3. If we say 4 electrons can go into either the conduction or the valence band. So if you actually go back to the experiments, and look, better wrap it up, but just to say, at this point, I would say there's nothing in any experiment which is inconsistent with this picture. So this is a kind of, obviously, a cartoon, not real experimental data, but it's a cartoon that Dima Efatov drew of his experiments, which are, I think, some of the most beautiful and comprehensive showing the presence of superconductivity in various correlated insulators. And one thing you'll notice is that the insulating states only occur at these integer fillings, okay? And they seem to occur at every integer filling, basically, depending which sample you look at. The superconductivity, I think things are less clear. There are various other experiments. Again, I don't know what Andrea showed you. He probably showed you his own experiments on quantum anomalous Hall effect. So that has, again, some simple explanation in this quantum Hall ferromagnet picture. Putting together the idea of the quantum Hall ferromagnet and what I told you at the very beginning about incipient Berry curvature of these Dirac points. If you polarize the valley, then you just put all the electrons in a state with one sign of the Berry curvature, and you just build up a non-zero valley. So that valley polarization, which is a kind of a flavor of ferromagnetism, flat band ferromagnetism, would seem to explain basically everything that we've seen in any of the insulating states.
But is there a particular reason why you should polarize? So, I mean, flat band ferromagnetism tells you it should go into a triplet state, but it doesn't really tell you that it should go into the maximum SZ, right? I mean, so is did the valley, is it obvious that it?
So the valley is interesting, and we start getting into details. So the valley actually, there's no SU2 symmetry associated with the valley, only a U1 symmetry. So there is less degeneracy. So this large degeneracy of ferromagnetic states is actually a property of the non-abelian nature of the SU2 group.
All I'm trying to say is that all that tells you is that the valley. But you know, it doesn't really tell you that you should load only one of them.
Oh, I mean, it doesn't have to break the valley symmetry, but if it does break the valley symmetry, then the natural state, again, if you want a gap, it will be a fully polarized state like this. There's no other way. But there's no analog of the different SE components for valley. I think I should stop. Be easy to go on, as you can imagine, since there are 100 theory papers written. So, but maybe this gives you enough of a flavor to start thinking about it.